You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Over 7 million different animals inhabit our planet.
I'm so excited to talk about one of the world's most obscure mammals right next to the platypus. They're closely related to, but the echidna.
What can they teach us?
So when an equine reproduction biologist downloads about 5 different papers and reads them from front to back, when she doesn't have time because she's supposed to be grading her assignments, and reads them all, You know that the animal has really cool reproductive anatomy.
Many species are in crisis and need your help. Join the movement at allcreaturespod.com.
Welcome to All Creatures Podcast. This is Chris.
And I'm Angie.
All right. And I pushed this forward. This has been on my list for a while. But I am so excited to talk about one of the world's most obscure mammals right next to the platypus. They're closely related to, but the echidna.
Yes, Chris, the echidna. Oh my gosh, it has spines like a porcupine, a pouch like a kangaroo, legs like a reptile. I mean, it's known as a spiny anteater, but it's actually not related to anteaters at all. I was really happy with this choice. It's going to be a lot of fun, this podcast. And you got to see one recently, too. You were sending me videos, which we'll share on social media. And I didn't know how endangered these creatures were as well, especially with them being such a unique, iconic egg-laying mammal. So we're going to talk a lot about their threats and conservation today and hopefully get everyone out there excited about the echidna. And the physiology is just mind blowing.
Yes. I texted Chris you 54 slides. I was I'm gonna talk quick today because there's every turn with this animal's physiology, you are just blown away. And there is the repro is really unique. So we're gonna get into detail. So again, for the youngins, if you want to fast forward through that section, we'll warn you before we get there, because it is talking about really insane male anatomy and differences in female anatomy. I mean, the egg-laying mammal.
I'm so pumped to talk all about echidna reproduction, because it's just amazing. It's crazy. It's fun. And it's not every day that I'll have a captive audience when I discuss it. So
yeah, I know.
Stick around.
Well, and I brought it forward because I was recently in Sydney with Pip, and we were seeing some friends, and we met with Melinda, who is a volunteer at the Taronga Zoo just outside Sydney, actually overlooks Sydney Harbor, but you can see the bridge and the Opera House in the background. Pip and I actually went to the Opera House one night. That was on my bucket list for so long, just inside. It was incredible. But, you know, shout out to Melinda. She's a veterinarian. She's been volunteering at the Taronga Zoo for many years. Took us all around, showed us all the different species. She introduced me to their director of education, Paul McGuire. He gave me a wonderful tour of their education facility. I'm going to talk more about it at the end of what Taronga Zoo is doing. This is a world-renowned, unique zoo. They are pushing education very hard, from the youngest children to adult education. It was phenomenal. It was phenomenal. I was blown away by it. And then he took me and showed me their frozen zoo. And Angie, in the freezer, they have half the species of coral from the Great Barrier Reef in there. And in the news is the Great Barrier Reef is collapsing.
I just saw that, Chris. Oh, we need to get a researcher on to talk about this.
Yep. But they have half the species of all coral frozen in their frozen zoo. Then we talked about the wildfires, all their equipment to prepare for emergencies, all the incredible stuff they're doing. And it is a gorgeous zoo. And you look out and there's Sydney. It's just, it's amazing. She did request we do the bush turkey. And Melinda, I'm going to do it this year. I promise you, because they are everywhere in Oz. And it was really interesting. She talked about them. They're an incredible bird. But when you showed me JR, who is a critically endangered long-beaked echidna, I was like, nope, we got to do that very, very soon. Because like Angie said, was not aware of how critically endangered some of these species are, where the long-beaked echidnas have experienced declines of at least 80% in the last 50 years in their populations. And they're critically endangered. We're going to talk about the all the species of them, the Western longbeak, the Sir David, who's named after Sir David Attenborough, who we're going to talk a little bit about today. His birthday is actually today, the day we released this on May 8th, but there was a longbeaked echidna they found again, they named after him, and then the Eastern longbeaked. Then you have the short-beaked echidna, which is least concerned. Their numbers are decreasing, but those ones are found all over Australia. So going to talk about them, but wow, just buckle down. This is one of these species that we come across, and Angie and I at every turn are just like, holy smokes, incredible.
So fun, yeah. So let's get rolling. It's going to be awesome.
So Angie, four species, three of them are the long-beaked. Then we have the short-beaked. All generally look alike, a little bit differences there, but how would you describe them?
Well, yeah, in general, for all four species, their appearance is similar to what we would see with a porcupine or a hedgehog as far as spikes go. All four species have these about 2-inch beige and black spikes, or spines, I think is a more appropriate word, that basically help them camouflage in the brush and act as a defense mechanism as well. And then in general, for the four species, they're usually black or brown in coloration, and the spines cover most all of their body. They start back behind the eyes and then go all the way down the rump. The forearms and hind legs don't have spikes on them, but they're also built really stocky. And would they have, in comparison to something like an anteater, like short legs, short kind of stocky legs. So when they're ambling and walking around, you really can't even see their legs. So it does look like they're completely covered in spines. And when it comes to their fur, as far as whether it's black or brown on their legs and their underside, the short beak echidna has dark fur, which is pretty much covered by these spines. Whereas the long beak echidnas have a little bit less fur and their spines are a little bit more visible. And then when you get to their face, super cute, so darling, they have a tiny face and a mouth, which we'll talk about because they have no teeth. So they have no teeth and a long tongue. Their eyes are small and dark in color, and their nose, which is sometimes called a beak, is either shorter, but still long, even though they're called short beaked echidnas, it's still long. It still protrudes and almost does look like a beak or a bill on a bird, which it's not. It's actually their nose. And then for the long beak echidna, I mean, it is out of this world. You have to Google a picture of it. I don't know how, I just won't do it justice, like Big Bird on steroids as far as the schnoz goes. And then, of course, I love at the very end, there's these two nostrils at the end of this just really long beak or nose. So just just something that you would see like in a Star Wars movie or something. And just not the long nose echidnas were, I had never seen one before until Chris sent me that video and I really started paying attention to it. So really, really fun. And then in addition to this big schnoz or nose, they have short, strong legs, like I mentioned, but with large claws, and they're really powerful diggers. So their hind claws are actually elongated and curved backwards to help in digging. And what's super fascinating when we talk about reproduction is both male and female echidnas have a pouch. So remember that from when we talk about reproduction with them being an egg-laying mammal. And then just something else that's pretty unique for a mammal, the male species of the Western long-nosed echidnas. And then also just little side physiology notes. The ears are slits on the side, hidden by the spines. So definitely a different face than a hedgehog, right? I always think of hedgehogs with the cute little ears and stuff. The echidna's ears are just little slits. And on the Western long-nosed echidna, the males can be distinguished by the females because they have a presence of a spur on the inner surface of each hind leg near the foot. And this is reminiscent of the platypus. So we'll talk about that spur today because the spur, physiologically speaking, is different in the echidna than it is in the platypus, because in the platypus, it's actually venomous, if you remember that, Chris. From way back in the day, we covered platypus a million years ago.
it was early on.
Yeah, well, after we released it, it was a fun episode. I remember that's when we were starting to like get our groove and be like, animals are so cool with all this cool physiology. So yes, I don't know if I did them justice. Definitely take a look at Google or on our show notes or in social media, because they're a really, really cool looking creature.
No, I think that's a great description. The long-beaked echidna came from the Star Wars universe. They're just so unique. Now, when you look at sizes, they do vary across the four species. The short-beaked echidnas, you know, weighing up to 15 pounds, 7 kilograms, you know, 17 and 18 inches long and body length up to 45 centimeters. So not tiny, but they're not huge. But I was surprised when I did see JR, and he was the Western long-beaked echidna. And they can get upwards of 36 pounds. So they get pretty big.
I didn't quite get 36. I saw 22 pounds. Maybe that's like average.
Eastern. Yeah, that's the Eastern long-beaked. Yeah, the Western. He was big. He's a big boy.
He was a big boy. That's why I got super excited when you sent me that video and wanted to cover that. I don't even know what this creature is. This is incredible.
Yeah, they're big. I'll release on social media. But he was, it's just so unique. Taronga Zoo has some amazing, if you follow them on social media, they have some amazing pictures of him on their Instagram account they released just a few months ago. So he is just, they're incredible. They're incredible species. Now, the short-beaked found throughout Australia, Tasmania. I read the deserts. They're up in the alpine regions. I got out to the Blue Mountains, just drop dead gorgeous outside Sydney. They're everywhere, and parts of New Guinea. So Papua New Guinea and then the Indonesian side of New Guinea. The Western, Eastern, and Sir David's are all isolated in New Guinea. So obviously the Western is on the Western side. The Eastern kind of runs down the middle in the Eastern side. And then Sir David's, they think they might be extinct. So they did find them again a few years ago with a trail camera. I'll tell that story here in a little bit. But upwards in the northern portions of New Guinea. And that's why they're, again, endangered, because in New Guinea, all the development, and they're hard to study. That's another thing. It's a unique place to go. And I think I'm going there soon, which I'll tell stories when I can get up there. Parts of that part of the world I'll be visiting soon, and I'll report back. But it's a difficult place in the world to go and study these creatures. So that's why some of this knowledge that we have is really a lot from the short beaked.
Right. But you mentioned Sir David's long beak being critically endangered at best. And then the Western longbeak echidna, also critically endangered. The Eastern longbeak, vulnerable, according to the ICUN. And it's really only the short beak echidna that is least concerned at this point in time. So
I was just
floored by that, because when we think of how, I know you talk about an evolution, but like how old they are, and then of course the physiology and how unique they are, being a monotreme or an egg-laying mammal along with the platypus. I know we'll nerd out about that, but I just was really shocking and made me sad, because I know you fell in love with them when you met JR at the Taronga Zoo, and and you spread that love to me, and now I'm like all echidna all day. I mean, I've read, I read so many papers prepping for this, especially the reproduction part.
Oh yeah,
just because they're so cool. Oh my gosh,
they are definitely one of the world's most unique mammals. I mean, by far, they definitely are. I mean, the platypus is right there with them, but you know, they're very, very closely related. And
And ancient.
They do, yeah, very ancient. We'll get there. But they are critical, too, to the environment. They are ecosystem engineers, right? Like that in the behaviors that they do. They are very important.
Yeah, Chris, I read a statistic that the average echidna will move around 200 cubic meters of soil each year when they're digging around. And when they turn over this much soil, it improves the water and the nutrients, and it helps evade runoff and erosion. It just makes healthier soils, and that way plants can grow. It's just really fascinating.
Yeah. Yeah, they just, especially in semi-arid regions, they say that's really critical. In the Gila monster we covered last week, we were talking about the biocrust and the deserts. And when you have the short-beaked echidna, you know, all over parts of Australia, you know, they are so important to that soil chemistry, just really important species. And so for this week, I know I've covered New Guinea before and some of the challenges there, palm oil development, I think cocoa development, some of that, it can be a little bit sketchy going there. But this week, I wanted to focus in on somebody that's inspired me and many of us, and that's Sir David Attenborough. And because they named a long-beaked echidna, I thought I just wanted to highlight him a little bit and tell his story just a tad in this podcast as he turns, I think, 97 in 2024. So he is a living legend. Watch all of his shows. He's putting them out all the time, and he's really a jewel. Listening to him, what he's seen in his career over the past, you know, 70 years, how the world has changed. He's seen this transition to where we are today. He's seen this loss of biodiversity, and being a naturalist and a TV presenter, you know, so he's giving his knowledge to this next generation. But when they found this long-beaked echidna in Indonesia's Cyclops Mountain, so that's the Indonesian side of New Guinea, they haven't seen it in 60 years. And so they did name it after him. Now, I do have that personal letter from him, handwritten during COVID.
I know. I have the biggest smile on my face from that. Oh, gosh.
He's
so
like,
great.
He doesn't do computers, so we can't interview him for the podcast, but I do have thank you, Pippa. That's upstairs in our bedroom on the wall, handwritten letter from Sir David himself. But he was born on May 8th, just 4 days after my birthday, in 1926. That was a little about 50 years before I was born. But he was born in Isleworth, England, so happy birthday, Sir David. Do you know his older brother, Lord Richard Attenborough?
I don't. You're the history buff. I lean on you for these things.
He says, "Welcome to Jurassic Park."
Oh, my boys will love that fact. That's great.
Yeah, John Hammond. He is his older brother. He passed away a few years ago, I think in 2014. But he was the very famous actor. You know, he's a huge actor. So talk about talented family, my goodness. But you know, he played John Hammond, so that's where most of us would know him from, Jurassic Park. But, you know, Sir David, like many of us, many of you listening, inspired at a young age by the natural world. He went off to Cambridge, got his degree in natural sciences, got his big break in the BBC in the 1950s. I actually read he was the first one to push color television early on. So
they were trying to, cool.
Yeah, he pushed for color TV early on. In the 1954, he began presenting on Zoo Quest, which ran from 1954 to 1963. Now, I'm going to tell Taronga Zoo's story a little bit later in the podcast. And I'm telling you, they are doing things that zoos around the world, like San Diego Zoo, and I know where John works, pushing education because the zoos have changed their missions since the 1950s. But ZooQuest was going out and capturing animals for zoos. They don't do that anymore. They don't bring in wild animals unless they are rescues or they can't be re-released to the wild. I know my days when I was volunteering, getting in monkeys that were rescued from the bushmeat trade, they could not be reintroduced to the wild. They would either be euthanized or they could be housed in a zoo. So they were housed at zoos in the United States. So ZooQuest was his early days. And in the early 70s, he left the BBC and became a full-time nature presenter. He's been in 333 different locations, 83 different countries, traveled the world. He's voiced many of our favorite nature documentaries. I've got, let me see a list, Planet Earth, Planet Earth 2, Life on Earth, The Blue Planet, The Living Planet, The Trials of Life, so many of these. He did Prehistoric Planet, which was awesome. Even though it wasn't, yeah, based on dinosaur bones and stuff, but that was an amazing series that we got to interview their head scientist last year. One of his biggest series was Life on Earth, that he visited 57 different filming locations. And he's been in the USA 57 times, Australia 37 times, all over the UK, Canada, China, New Zealand. He's been here 7 times. He's been all over the world. And I just want to play one of his quotes in Perfect Planet, and then I'll go into the long-beaked echidna before we take our break. So real quick, I'm going to play this quote.
For over 60 years, I've been privileged to witness the natural world in all its wonder. But the planet I saw as a young man has changed beyond recognition. Human activity is now so dominant, it's disrupting the forces of nature and the vital habitats that life needs to survive on Earth. Carbon dioxide acts like a blanket, trapping the sun's heat. This raises the temperature and so destabilizes one of the most important forces on Earth, the weather. Right now, we have the capacity and knowledge to stop the damage we are doing. But what we don't have is time.
Now, this Attenborough's long-beaked echidna had not been seen since 1961. And just recently, Oxford University scientists set up some trail cameras. And when he came down, he had over 80 remote different cameras, and they spotted this long-beaked echidna that they thought it was lost to time. They thought it went extinct. So being that they refound this species, they named it after Sir David Attenborough for all the stuff he's done in his life to inspire me, you, everybody listening to do more for the planet. What is interesting is the peoples of New Guinea, I'll just quote this article, it said, the echidna is embedded in the local culture, including a tradition that state conflicts are resolved by sending one party to a disagreement into the forest to search for the long-beaked echidna and the another to the ocean to find a marlin. And both creatures were seen as so difficult to find that it would often take decades or a generation to locate them. But once found, the animals symbolize the end of the conflict and the return to a harmonious relationship. So it just, you can't find these echidnas. They are so elusive and so rare.
Goodness. Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah. And just to end this on Sir David Attenborough, one of his most famous quotes is, "It seems to me that the natural world is the greatest source of excitement, the greatest source of visual beauty, the greatest source of intellectual interest. It is the greatest source of so much in life that makes life worth living." So with that, let's take a quick break, and we're going to come back and keep telling more about this incredible creature. Welcome back. Evolution of the echidna. Oh, let me get through the classification. Mammals. The infraclass is marsupialae. Leah? Marsupialae? Marsupials. Okay. So over 330 species. Again, most of them live in Australia and then New Guinea. The others in South America. And the one in North America, the Virginian opossum. I do want to do another possum species in Central or South America soon. Okay. Order monotremes.
Mm-hmm.
So we have the echidnas and the platypus. Now, where do they live again, Angie? The platypus?
Sander? This is South America. Is that what Sander said years ago?
Yeah, this is an inside joke for our longtime listeners. I interviewed Angie's son, Sander, about the platypus for the podcast. And I asked him where they lived, and he said, the Amazon River. He's only three at the time, or not even four. And I was like, are you sure? And he was like, yep. I was like, okay.
He still has that confidence. Gotta love it. Gotta love it.
I'm sure he knows. They are from Australia, yes. But these egg-laying mammals, they're ancient. Now, the family is Tachyglossidae, and these are echidnas, the four species. There's two genera, the genus, Zaglossus and Tachyglossus. So the Zaglossus is the genus for the long-beaked echidnas. So you have the Western, the Sir Davids, and the Eastern. And then the Tachyglossus is the short-beaked echidna. Now, there are five subspecies of short-beaked echidnas, so which makes sense because Australia is so massive. And so you would get some speciation a little bit. But you do have a subspecies in the Northern Territories or Western Australia. Then the one subspecies, Queensland, New South Wales, South Australia, and Victoria. That's where I was just at. Then there is another one that's way up in Northwest Queensland. So that's, or Northeast Queensland. So that's up near New Guinea. Then there's Kangaroo Island, which I want to get to someday, Angie. God, that's, when you get over here, you're going to need like a month. We'll do 2 weeks in New Zealand, 2 weeks in Oz.
I love and everything then, about that.
Yeah, yeah. Kangaroo Island I need to get to. And then Tasmania. So, what do you talk about monotremes when it comes to evolution? One genetic study estimates that they broke off from mammals 220 million years ago. And others estimate 160 to 180 million years ago.
They're living fossils. They're living fossils. Yes. It's crazy. Yeah. It's crazy. That is in my another reason of why I care, because it's just incredible. And they do have a unique physiology, maybe it's somewhat bizarre for mammals, if you will. But the more they're doing some of these studies and learning about them and able to compare them and all the genetics and all this stuff and looking at the DNA and what echidnas have versus what platypuses have versus what hedgehogs have or anteaters or mammals. It's really fascinating. And so there's so much that we can learn about the past and where we came from and evolution just by studying these creatures. And if they're not around, if they're extinct, which three of the four species are on the verge of being extinct, if not already, like you said, which is possible with Attenborough. I mean, yeah, we need these guys around so we can just be in awe and learn more about them.
Yeah. I mean, 220 million, because that's really when mammals arose next to dinosaurs and all the large reptiles were already there. But Yeah, that's how long they go back. And there's only two monotremes left, the platypus and the echidna. Now, when we talk about this, the split with the platypus and the echidna, oh gosh, wide range, 17 million years ago to 89 million years ago. They all believe that there was like a platypus-like ancestor. Platypus went one way, the echidnas went the other. This was interesting, though. I did find this data. So the platypus have teeth, the echidnas don't. And of the eight genes involved in tooth development, four have been lost in both the platypus and echidna. So they lost those genes before the split. Then they split tens of million years ago. And then the echidna lost all their teeth, where the platypus still has it. So echidna's ancient and emerged as late as 20 million years ago. Again, very difficult to study. Not many fossils found in New Guinea because there's not a lot of people able to go there and look up and look for fossils. So still a lot to learn about them. But, you know, very ancient species, these monotremes, and they deserve our protection, our respect, and again, learning more about them.
Oh, absolutely, Chris. It can't be stressed enough. I mean, every unique physiological thing about them was just so fun to study this week.
Yeah. All right. So let's get into their physiology because we can definitely get into repro because the repro just will blow you away. But lifespan of echidna, 16 years in the wild, some think under 10. JR is close to 60, I think. So lived a long time. And the reason they call him JR, so for our American listeners or older crowd, he was from the Dallas Zoo. And they named him after J.R. Ewing from
Dallas.
Yeah, Dallas.
I remember that. My mom watching her stories at nighttime.
Who shot J.R.? Well, not J.R. the platypus or platypus. J.R. the echidna. No, it was J.R. Ewing in that TV show. So they named him J.R. And then he came back to Australia where he's been under human care.
But you're telling me he's 60 years old?
Close to 60, yeah. Yep.
Wow, because they were saying that on average 30 years, but up to 45 or 50 under human care, but 60, JR's breaking records. That's incredible.
Yeah, it's just on the Taronga Zoo Instagram account, this beautiful picture of him. They said, JR, the long-beaked echidna is back, splishing and splashing his way into the new year. JR is one of the rarest and most endangered animals we have at Taronga and is almost 60 years old and the only place to witness a majestic long beak echidna. So
that's
very
incredible. Yay, JR, happy birthday, a belated birthday. And then also, I mean, that actually fits into one of my first amazing fun physiological facts, I think is what my slide is titled, but that the echidna has their body temperature on average is the second lowest out of all mammals.
Like six slides on that. It's insane.
So it's just like, what? How? Huh? Of course, I had to look up the first lowest, which is the platypus.
Okay, but I found something, even the world record for the lowest. Could you guess world record for the lowest mammalian body temperature ever recorded? That's where a lot of my slides are, because I was like, what?
Well, so I have that the echidnas on average are 32 degrees Celsius or 89 degrees Fahrenheit. Yeah. So that is low. I don't know if that's the lowest, and it can fluctuate a lot over the day by 6 to 8 degrees Celsius throughout the day, depending on where they live and what the temperature is and what they're doing. But is that about what you found? I mean, 89, that's cold.
And echidnas go through what, daily topor? They shut down and they get down to 53 degrees Fahrenheit or 11.6 Celsius. They do it all day, like, because that's part of their survival mechanism. They may just shut down for a while. Their temperature drops. But, okay. They do deep hibernation in the autumn and winter. So now, this time of year, May 8th, when this drops, it's autumn or winter. It's close to winter here. So it's getting colder. And so all the short-beaked echidnas are doing some topor and deep hibernation. But the lowest ever recorded in a mammal. If you had to guess Fahrenheit, what would you guess if you measured body temperature?
I mean,
this fact blew me away.
40 degrees?
Lower, but okay.
I mean, it has right. to be above 32 or they'd be like an icicle.
No, they don't. This is what blew me away. Minus 3 degrees Celsius or 26 degrees Fahrenheit. The lowest body temperature ever recorded is in the Arctic ground squirrel. We gotta cover this species at some point. Their body temperature drops below freezing when they are hibernating. They have a 9-month hibernation period because the ground is so cold. I was like, what? I have to do a little bit more digging. Again, this is why I had so many slides today.
Yeah, I'm putting my seatbelt on here, buddy. Yeah. I need to know more about that. I know, sorry, you came here for the echidna, but you're going to get a little Arctic ground squirrel.
Well, when you talk about echidnas having low body temps, and I start looking, and I was like, okay, what's the lowest? And I came across this. I was like, oh my goodness. So they're obligate hibernators. They have to hibernate up to 7 to 8 months. The permafrost or wherever they sleep, the ground gets like minus 20 degrees. It freezes. And during hibernation, the Arctic ground squirrels, they get that low. It drops below freezing. They call it super cooling. And I was like, how do they survive? I mean, is the blood that viscous? Mm-hmm. But this super cooling period, it is like, okay, what do we do when we go to freeze eggs, horse, rhino, elephant embryos or eggs? What do we do with them before we freeze them? What do we have to do?
You put a cryoprotectant in there.
There, okay. Now, ground squirrel can't do that, but what does the cryoprotectant do? What does it do?
It keeps it from freezing. Medium? No. Medium? Okay. Hold on. Let's do charades here.
Let's do prelims.
I'll turn
again.
My camera back on.
Thanks. All right. So it removes
water.
Hey, there you go. That's the super cooling. So water.
Okay, I wish everyone listening could see Chris's clue where he takes his water bottle. He's like squirting it in his mouth. But it helped me get there, buddy. So I appreciate
it. Okay. So when we go to, say, freeze, and I've done this with multiple species, but oocytes or embryos, we put them in a cryoprotectant, which removes the water from the cells so that when they freeze, they don't form ice, which will break up DNA and harm the cells. The Arctic ground squirrel, sorry, echidna, but it super cools and it somehow clears its blood and other fluids of water molecules. Like taking out that water to allow them to go to topor and allow them to hibernate and get to that temperature where they don't freeze. They're like freeze dried almost.
It's incredible.
And to come out of it, this is what's even cooler about this species, is 2 to 3 weeks, they'll still be sleeping, but their body will start to shiver and shake for up to 15 hours a day. And that heat warms them back up to normal body temperature of 98 degrees Fahrenheit. It's insane. It's insane. Anyways, sorry, echidna. I had to go there. But for echidnas to drop to 53 Fahrenheit or close to 11.5 degrees C, I mean, that's crazy. That's cold, you know, when they're doing that.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah. But that's the thing. The echidnas have these slow and long lives, especially if they're JR and they get so well taken care of.
Yeah, especially for a smaller mammal. I mean, that's, you know, metabolism slower, not aging as quickly. They're able to live a little bit longer. Now, how fast are they? Could they catch you?
I don't think so.
No. I mean, I would just stand there and let them catch me so they can walk around me and I just stand still. But yeah, they're not very fast. Echidnas, 1.5 miles per hour or 2.3 kilometers per hour. And they usually walk at like 0.5 mile an hour. So, or 1 kilometer per hour. So they're very slow.
Well, and I had fun watching the videos of them walking. It's kind of a waddle, if you will. But it just basically looks like these spines moving. But fun fact, they can swim. And they're actually pretty good swimmers. And they use it to help themselves groom sometimes when they're in the water. And yeah, I thought that was pretty interesting when I first read about it. But then learning that they probably evolved or had a lineage with platypus at some point in time, which of course are swimming monotremes, it made a little bit more sense. But I guess for some reason with the spines, I just thought, well, maybe they wouldn't. But doing a little bit more digging into the spine or quill physiology is, even though they are sharp and pokey, like a porcupine or a hedgehog, the echidna's spines are actually just modified hairs. Mm-hmm. So, and keep in mind that they have these spines all over their bodies, except for their undersides, their faces, and their legs. But it is, the spines are made of keratin, which is that compact protein. And that's the same protein that makes up nails and claws, horns, like in our rhinos. So yeah, it's just evolved to, it's hair that's evolved to, of course, be more of a defense mechanism, and just really, really fascinating.
Oh, just, here we go. Then their limbs, they're rapid digging. So they have strong claws. They dig really quickly. They're super strong. Scientists saw them move a 30-pound stone, no problem, or that's 13 and a half kilograms.
Wow. Yeah.
Yeah. They're super muscular and...
Yeah, their body, their legs are like stocky. They're just like... Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting is they can survive in high levels of carbon dioxide because they dig deep and they go underground. So this was...
Hello, naked mole rat.
Yes, yes, like that. And that's an awesome episode too. If no one's heard that one, gosh, I might have to re-release that one. Just an incredible species. So they can survive with low oxygen. So when those devastating fires happened in Australia, this was a species that could burrow and survive it and come back out and be okay. So again, like I said, everything... Their eyes are reptilian-like and they're mammal-like. They don't pant or sweat. You just keep going.
No, they blow bubbles.
Yeah.
Did you read that?
No, I didn't see that one.
Yes. And so when echidnas need to cool off, what they do is they like to keep the tip of their beak wet. And what they'll do is they'll blow mucus bubbles to aid moisture at the tip of their beaks, which will evaporate and help aid in heat loss. Oh, so they basically, echidnas blow bubbles from their nose. It keeps it wet.
so
that's not, obviously a different mechanism, cooling mechanism than sweating or panting, but it works as a form of evaporative cooling. And so, yeah, it's just so fun.
Yeah. Well, and then we talked about the long beak, their snout, their nose and mouth is at the end of that snout.
And do you know what else?
Go ahead. Well, they have that long tongue, right? Mm-hmm. What else?
Mm-hmm. Do you know what else is on that elongated, slender snout, both in the short-beaked and the long-beaked?
Oh, gosh. Let's play charades. Let me see.
Oh, shoot. This is a really hard one. And you would never want me as your partner. I'm like a choker. I don't do well under pressure. Oh my gosh, I've been playing the New York mini crossword puzzle and my friends beat me every day because I just am like, But anyways, let me think about it. Okay. So,
Well, they have their nostrils. They have their mouth.
I got some. Okay.
Plug? A plug entered
what,
plug?
What is in the coming out of the plug into the wire?
The cord? So their tongue, right? Their tongue comes out.
No, but this is the most fun I've had like in a long time. Okay. So but what is like in the power strip, what is coming into
out of the plug?
Yeah, that we need.
Power.
Correct.
Energy.
Or
power?
Yeah.
Electrons? Electricity.
Mm-hmm.
What?
That's first word.
Electricity?
Well, not electricity, like half of that word.
Electric? Shock?
Uh-huh.
No. I didn't read that.
No, they don't have electric shock. But okay. They can, like...
You're there. Oh, my God.
Oh, like, it's coming into them. They can...
Smell, very good. Olfactory.
Senses. Electric sensors.
Kind of like sharks. It's kind of like sharks,
yes,
right?
and platypuses, if you remember back. That was about 5 years ago we did that episode. But sorry, team. You can edit all that out, but it was hilarious.
Well, cut it down.
Echidnas have within their elongated slender snouts these electrosensors similar to the platypus. Remember, the platypus can't see, and it's diving in all that murky water, and how does it find its food? So the echidna is in the dirt looking for its food, and we haven't covered nutrition yet, but we'll talk about the echidnas eat earthworms and termites and ants and stuff like that. And so in order to help them find their prey in their nose or this beak, they have these electric sensors to basically help them find and locate prey. Now, mind you, the platypus, their electrosensors on their bill are way more robust. So one study I read, it stated that the platypus has about 40,000 electroreceptors on its bill, where the long beaked has about 2,000 and the short beak only has about 400 at the tip of its snout. So it's probably why you didn't come across this fact. I had to do a lot of digging, but it's not as well known as it is in the platypus, but they do indeed have that ability.
It reminds me, I remember the star-nosed mole we covered, 200 episodes ago. Had something like that, right?
Exactly. Yeah. So yeah, really fun and cool. And then just the other interesting platypus-like fact is that male echidnas have a spur on their hind foot, similar to the platypus. However, in the echidna, the spur is non-venomous, so it doesn't do anything. Where with the platypus, it is actually venomous. So very fascinating, and a difference in some of their evolutionary steps there. But fun facts. I would have had no idea.
No, that's crazy. I mean, they have the long tongue, like 7 inches or 18 centimeters. They eat incredible amounts. They said the short beaks can ingest 200 grams of termites in 10 minutes. They've known to eat roughly 40,000 different ants, termites, worms, or whatever per day. They eat a ton.
They use their long, sticky tongue to help capture the prey in the dirt or under tree bark or whatever they're looking for. Mm-hmm. And so I was reading about the long beak echidnas. They actually have sharp, small spines, a little bit different anatomically speaking than the ones on their backs. But these spines help them capture their prey. And similar to the short beaks, they have no teeth, so they break their food down basically by just mashing their upper and lower jaws together and moving their tongue around. So no teeth.
No. All right. Well, we got to get to behavior and repro. So things that hunt echidnas, feral cats, foxes, dogs, iguanas, snakes may get into the burrows and eat the young. I think any big predator out there that came across them might try to go after them, but
yeah,
I don't know if quolls do or not.
But fun fact with the echidnas, similar to a hedgehog, although not related very closely, echidna will curl up in a ball when they become frightened. So they do look, of course, scary to a predator with all those spikes, but they actually are quite shy. And if a predator does come after them or they are spooked or frightened, they will tuck into a ball, kind of like an armadillo, tucking its snout and legs in to protect themselves. So, but as Chris mentioned, these spines aren't really a match for cars or larger predators,
humans,
dogs, humans.
All right. What behaviors do we know? What do we know about them?
Well, Chris, you touched on this a little bit at the beginning of the podcast. There's still a lot that we don't know about echidnas in general, especially when it comes to the long-beaked, because they are so hard to study. But I was pleasantly surprised to find several papers, especially about their reproductive behavior, and even then a little bit more so about just their general behavior that have been done under human care in zoos. In general, echidnas don't do well with reproduction under human care. However, in Australia, there are certain zoos and wildlife centers that have gotten better at it and are trying to learn more about it. But what we do know when it comes to their social behavior about echidnas is they typically are believed to be solitary. And they will come together, of course, for reproduction. And there was just a new paper out, which I was pretty excited about, that demonstrated several vocalizations of echidnas, including cooing sounds, grunting sounds, wheezing or exhalation sounds. And historically, it was always thought that they just made sniffing noises, which makes sense, especially like the long-beaked with that schnoz. But these new recordings that were captured under human care showed that they actually have a little bit more of a vocal repertoire than thought. And it was noted by the research group that these vocalizations were only recorded and observed during courtship and reproduction during that time. So they think that some of these sounds are part of the love language between echidnas when they come together to breed. Mm-hmm. And that's just my other plug here, really quick, a little sidebar about why we care about accredited zoos and aquariums, because studies like this that just cannot be done in the wild at this point in time because of the way that the animal lives, or like Chris mentioned, them being in torpor or hibernation, living, burrowing underneath the grounds and things like that, or when it comes to the long-beaked echidnas, there's just not that many of them to study to begin with. Mm-hmm. These accredited zoos and wildlife centers that take great care of their animals, they are helping us learn more about their biology, their physiology, and their behavior, especially for endangered and critically endangered animals, so that we can better know how to protect them in the wild, right? Mm-hmm. So that's just my plug for why we should care about our accredited zoos and aquariums, because they're churning out really cool data when it comes to some of these more obscure species in general and what their behavior looks like.
So I read some because I just had to, but
he couldn't resist, not just, folks.
No, the physiology is crazy, which Angie's going to talk about. But also what I found cute was the behavior of the males in a train following a female. I thought that was awesome. So anyways.
Yes, yes. Yeah. I was going to make my chugga-chugga-choo-choo sound. And yep, so yep, Chris yep. is right. Yeah. So when they are courting, it'll typically be a male echidna. When a female echidna is in estrus, which we don't really know a lot about, researchers at zoos are trying to figure out what an estrus window looks like and things like that. But what we do know is one female will be bred by several males. And during courtship, one of the cool behaviors they do is what they call a mating train, where one male will follow behind a female, and then several males follow behind, like that male, then the next male, then the next male, like a little choo-choo train, which is just so cute. But when a female is receptive to a male, echidna, he'll basically smell her under regions with his long or short beak, and he'll paw at the female's flanks and tail. And a lot of times the female, if she is receptive, the female echidna will roll on her side and be receptive to the male copulating with her. And a female, and one study suggested the female may breed with several males throughout her estrus period. So yeah, really, really cute courtship behavior. But once again, when it comes to like the long-beak echidnas, there's still just so much that we don't know because they just haven't really been observed in the wild, and there's not a lot of them under human care.
Just a warning, if you want to fast forward, we're going to get in some anatomy because they have some crazy anatomy. That's all the way I could put it. It's like nothing you've ever seen in the mammal world before, right?
So when an equine reproduction biologist downloads about 5 different papers and reads them from front to back when she doesn't have time because she's supposed to be grading her assignments and reads them all, yeah, you know that the animal has really cool reproductive anatomy. Mm-hmm. And so without further ado, the male echidna has a four-headed penis. You heard me right, folks. A four-headed penis. Now, with that being said, he does not use all four heads of his penis when he copulates with a female. And I, of course, being the scientist that I am, had to look up several photos and try to understand the mechanisms and things like this. And I will give you the summary because nobody besides myself or maybe Chris would want to read all five of these papers that I found. Mm-hmm. But what happens is during copulation with a female echidna, two of the heads of the male echidna's penis basically shut down, aren't in use, do not grow larger, and have like a more erectile tissue state. So two don't do anything and two do. And when he breeds a female, this is extremely critical because to talk about the female anatomy of the echidna, she doesn't have a traditional vagina and cervix like we see in most mammals. She basically just has a uterus, but she has two of them. Okay. Now she typically only gives birth to one egg. So we'll get there in a second. Hold on to your hats, folks. Strap in. Put your seatbelt on. But she does have two uteruses. So the fact that when a male breeds a female, that there are two heads that basically have erectile tissue, it works pretty perfect as far as fitting, lock, and key. It's also important to note for all my reptile fans out there that echidnas, of course, are weird, right? They're these oddballs. They have a very unique physiology. So when I say that she doesn't really have a vagina or a cervix, both male and females, echidnas basically have a cloaca. So it's just a general tube with a single opening that is used to urinate, defecate, and mate. So that tube basically in the female leads into two uteri. Fascinating. Now, switching back to the male echidna anatomy, when he breeds the female, the male has two of the heads of the penis enlarged. And so when the male echidna is breeding the female, two of the heads of the penis will breed the female and release sperm. And then the next female that he breeds, because once again, the male will breed several females during their breeding season. The next female he breeds, he will actually alternate and he will use the other two penis heads to breed the next female that had laid dormant and quiet in the previous breeding. So he alternates sides back and forth like these, like number one and two and then number three and four. And so all four heads can get erect. And I really went down a deep, dark rabbit hole of like,
there's so many jokes in here, but we're not that type of podcast.
Well, no, I'm a nerd. I was reading histology because I'm like, okay, like, so I'm like, they, you know, all the heads have a blood supply so they can have erectile tissue. But how do the two know to become erect and then the other two don't?
Why? I'm sitting here. Why would they evolve that? I mean, I get it. She has two uteri, so you would need two. Why do you need four?
I don't know, Chris. This is what I was reading.
What gives them an advantage of having four? Why not eight? Like, I glow. I go. Yeah,
it's really, really. And then the fact that once again that the female has two uteri is kind of like silly or a waste of space because she usually only she doesn't even carry a baby. She carries, you know, there's an egg that develops and then that comes out of her cloaca. And yes, it's crazy fascinating. But what we do know too that's pretty fascinating is the male sperm will form what's called sperm bundles. And researchers think that might have something to do with sperm competition, because if you're a female and you're being bred by multiple males in during your estrus cycle, then the sperm that has, I guess, bundles together, stays together, swims faster. Because one study showed that sperm that was bundled actually swims faster than like individual sperms in the echidna. So they think sperm bundles might be a possible adaptation for sperm competition to help increase male fitness. But yeah, at the end of the day, there's just so much we don't know. And I had fun learning about it and trying to understand it a little bit. And once again, researchers too are just starting to be able to dive into this a little bit, because once again, it's just been something that we've known historically for a while. It's been something from an anatomical point of view that researchers have known for a while, but the actual functionality of it and why is still at the tip of the iceberg. Pardon the pun.
So we get mating, and she's again breeding to multiple males, but only one egg.
Yeah. Yeah. So
yeah, that's crazy.
Once
yeah.
again, we got to reiterate, like, the cliff notes of this whole podcast mm-hmm. is that the echidna is one of the only egg-laying mammals besides the platypus, these monotremes. Yeah. It's just crazy. But they mm-hmm. lay eggs, but then the young drink milk. Just fascinating. So fun. And so what happens is, depending on where the echidnas live, I'll focus mostly on the short-beak echidnas because we know the most about them. But the breeding seasons will be between July and August. And I already went through the breeding and the copulation and how that happens. So once a single egg is fertilized, by egg I mean oocyte, is fertilized by a male, it'll develop and it'll form a kind of leathery, not super hard, not as hard as like an eggshell, but an egg, okay? And it's usually, on average, it can be anywhere from 10 to 20 days. I think the difference between depends on whether it's a short beak echidna or a long beak echidna. But once this egg develops in her uterus, I presume, the female will then lay it, I have no better word, it'll pass it through her cloaca, and then she puts it in her pouch. So I guess think kangaroo. Mm-hmm. I watched a close-up video of it from 1974. So we'll share that on the podcast. It's really fascinating. Yeah. I don't know how they did it, but it's almost like they put a camera inside the pouch or something. But at any rate, so the egg will be in her pouch for about 10 days before hatching, and then up to 20, depending on the species. And then the offspring will hatch. Fun fact, the offspring of an echidna, similar to a platypus, is called a puggle. Yay!
Puggle, that's cute. That's cute. Mm-hmm,
one of the other best fun facts of this podcast. And so this video showed at birth, a puggle weighs 0.02 ounces. You heard me right.
Tiny.
That's 0.02.
Tiny.
Is less than a half an inch long and looks like a gelatinous beetle jelly bean. I mean, it has the shape of an echidna. No spines. Thank gosh for that poor mom. No spines have developed. And it's very, very, very underdeveloped. Whenever I was giving tours about kangaroos that we used to have at the zoo that I worked at, I always just say it's like a little jelly bean, literally like looks like the tissue looks like jelly, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. crawls into the mom's pouch in the kangaroo species. And so I would say, even though they're different, evolutionarily speaking, than a marsupial, there is some resemblance to that as far as this echidna puggle being crazy underdeveloped. Like so underdeveloped that when they drink milk, not from a nipple, the mom echidna does not have nipples, but she actually secretes milk, which that's why she's a mammal. She secretes milk from specialized glands within her pouch for her puggle. And the puggle, I guess, laps up the milk that's from the glands. And they show in this video, the puggle is so small and underdeveloped that when it takes a drink of milk, you can see the milk in its stomach because they're so clear and transparent. Hmm. Fascinating. Just very underdeveloped.
Yeah.
But anyways, the puggle will stay in the pouch for about anywhere from 40 to 55 days. At this time, it's growing and developing, and it will start to develop spines. Ouch! So that's when the mother echidna will use her powerful claws and dig what's known as a nursery burrow to deposit her young there. Now, she doesn't leave her young. In fact, the echidna is a very dedicated mother, which is also fascinating considering they're such an ancient creature. The mother puggle will remain with and around the offspring puggle for about 7 months or so. And what she'll do is she leaves the young in this nursery burrow, goes out and probably hunts and has to regain. She goes out and hunts and has to regain strength, and then she'll come back to her den and let the young suckle from her milk glands. And so they're a puggle is typically weaned around 7 months, but researchers say that it actually might be a year before they depart ways and go their separate ways. So that was really surprising to me. I mean, you don't really often see that much dedication or that such a long weaning period in that type of animal. So a lot of commitment there, and just really, really fascinating. And
I know.
We'll share the video maybe on social media or definitely on our are definitely on our website, but it was really fascinating to watch the puggle develop in the pouch and just, yeah, so fascinating.
Yeah. Well, it's just one a year. It's just for.
Oh, and then a really quick sidebar. It's just a quick sidebar for my reptile fans out there, my herpers.
Yeah.
The puggle, even though it's very underdeveloped when it hatches from the egg, it has an egg tooth.
Yeah, I was going to ask. Yeah. Yep.
Which is what we see in reptiles that help them break out of their egg, their shell. Yeah. Uh-huh. And a puggle has one. Fascinating.
Ancient mammal. I mean, the echidnas and the platypus. It's just crazy. Well, the good news is for the short-beaked echidna, there's millions of them in Australia. Hard to get numbers, but anywhere from 5 to 50 million is what the sources are saying.
Great.
So short beaks are fine. I mean, they're all over Australia, and they're protected, and the Aussies love them. I mean, they're a great species. It's Papua New Guinea. That is where we're having, you know, very big concerns. Or New Guinea, the other side of that part of the island. But Sir David's critically endangered, but it could be extinct. We don't know. They saw it once, and that's it. The Western long-beaked is critically endangered, population decreasing. Again, don't have estimates there. The Eastern long-beaked is vulnerable. They think maybe up to 10,000 left. But again, a part of the world that's very difficult to get to and study these animals. But like Angie said, getting run over by vehicles, cats, dogs. On Kangaroo Island, feral cats and pigs are causing a lot of problems for them there, in these subspecies. But humans, you know, hunt them. They prize the meat. They're not as protected as they once were by the native peoples there, where they used to be like kind of revered and taken care of. And dogs find them really easily, so they're easily hunted down. And then you have habitat destruction is another big problem. So you got to keep an eye on them because, I mean, they're just, especially the long beak, they're just so incredible looking. So that brings me to our organization of the week. And I just want to highlight the Taronga Zoo in Sydney, just doing incredible work, research with species in the water and on land. And of course, they're conserving the most iconic species of Australia. But the one, again, this took me back to LA Zoo, where they were on the mountain frog that we covered a few years ago. And I remember interviewing Ian. They're doing things that people don't see, right? This is what Taronga Zoo's doing. When I see an exhibit and them talking about all their frog conservation, they're amphibians. So the Southern Corroboree frog, sorry if I said that wrong to all my Aussies out there. But the spotted tree frog, the yellow spotted bell frog, the burrow long frog, they are doing so much conservation work for these animals, doing captive breeding, then release programs, that it is so critical to the ecosystems of Australia and the world that all the other zoos are doing. That is where when people are like attacking zoos, they don't realize what zoos do. They're doing such critical conservation work. And that is just one of the things that Taronga Zoo is doing. Like I said, the frozen zoo, their education center was huge. There was kids everywhere for the day being taught about animals, being taught about conservation. They do wildlife rehab, so they did take in animals after the fire. So they're working with young children, high school students, and then college students. They were doing research with PhD scientists. They offer courses in conservation and zookeeping and animal care, veterinary profession. They have a bachelor's program. They're working with the universities. I was blown away, Angie. I go to San Diego Zoo. That's my hometown zoo, world famous. I love everything they're doing. But then when I, go around New Zealand or go around Australia and see things like what Taronga Zoo is doing, if you go to Sydney, Australia, go to Taronga Zoo, please. Go visit, track down Melinda, tell her thank you, for her reaching through me to you. It takes a village to change this around the planet so we can save species like the Attenborough long-beaked echidna and all the other species that, and we got more coming, the bush turkeys coming in the future. I want to do the bilby. There's so many amazing animals in this part of the world, Angie, that we need to do. But, thanks for all the stuff you've done today. It's been a journey. This has been one of those species that every week I love learning about these animals, but this one I just was like, oh my goodness, I could not.
Oh
wait,
yeah, I have like one or two more papers tagged that I didn't even have time to read. So yeah, it was a super fun species, the echidna. Oh my gosh, like share this episode, tell your friends. Let's normalize talking about reproductive anatomy if we're using the terms correctly. Mm-hmm. I teach it all the time to me, so okay. My students always giggle, but it's a cool species with a really important story to share, and I really appreciate you for bringing your 54 slides today and all your wonderful energy. And so thanks, Chris, and thanks to all of our listeners.
Yeah. Please share this episode. That's how we continue to grow. So thank you for that. Thank you for the kind words. Keep those emails coming. Keep those recommendations coming. I know we've got the next one we're going to cover. Mm-hmm. This thing lives a long, long, long time. So there's your hint. So look for that.
Listen, learn, share. Join the movement at allcreaturespod.com.